Breathing loudly. Could be from panic. Mark.
You're going too far, Brianna. I'm not into this. I don't even know you right now.
Brianna checked each of the ties, then slowly undressed, folding her jacket, sweater, slacks, stacking them on the chair. She peeled off her panties and passed them over Mark's face, then hung her bra over the footboard. Mark strained at the ties and could be heard saying,
"This is crazy! This is wrong! This isn't going to work, Brianna!"
"We'll see about that," she said. When she was naked, she got onto the bed and, kneeling between Mark's spread legs, manipulated his genitals with her hands and her mouth before she mounted him. Two women jurors partially covered their eyes, but there was no way to shut out the sounds of both parties breathing hard, moaning, Brianna saying,
"Say it, Mark. You like this. This is what you want."
Brianna's rising, falling, grinding motions would continue for another 5 minutes and some seconds. Yuki had an impulse to grab the remote and hit fast forward. Arthur shot her a questioning look, and she shook her head no. Eventually, the sounds stopped. Yuki knew that Brianna had rolled off Mark's body, pulled up the blankets around her shoulders, and fallen asleep without untying him or speaking again. Yuki said,
"Your Honor, both parties slept until the camera's memory card was full and had stopped recording."
The judge muttered,
"Thank God."
Art shut down the laptop, crossed to the front of the room, and brought up the lights. Yuki felt blasted as the dim light gave way to brightness in the courtroom. She looked at the jurors. She had never seen a jury look so shattered. Even the judge looked disturbed. He grabbed at the tissue box and blew his nose. Yuki said,
"The people enter this recording into evidence, Your Honor."
"Done. And this would be a good time to take a half-hour recess. Back here at 11 sharp."
He brought down the gavel and left the courtroom. Chapter 74. During the half-hour recess, Art helped Mark to the men's room, sat with him in the corridor, and told him that he had done a great job on the stand. He said casually,
"I must have missed the part where Brianna said she wanted the best bonk of her life."
Mark answered,
"I'd forgotten. It just came back to me."
Yuki used the time to think through every last word that Mark had spoken. She questioned much of it. She got a bottle of water from the vending machine and, keeping an eye on the time, got back to the prosecution table as Art was helping Mark up to the witness stand. Arthur joined her at their table and updated her on his brief chat with Mark.
"He said he'd had a sudden recurrence of memory," said Art. "It was like a miracle."
A moment later, Brianna Hill and Madison Benson returned to the defense table. Brianna was nodding as if Madison had given her an affectionate buck-up speech. The spectators filled the gallery, no doubt wondering what the hell had happened that had caused the judge to throw them out. Then the jury came in and took their places in the box. Some of them still looked as though a bomb had gone off in front of their faces. At 11 sharp, the judge took the bench, and a moment before the doors were closed, James Giftos sat down at his counsel table. Yuki guessed that he had used the recess to sharpen his knives and prepare himself to give the cross-examination of his career. Red Dog Parisi had once told Yuki that litigation was a storytelling contest, and the best story won. James Giftos had a mighty big job ahead of him if he hoped to undermine the prosecution's story. Yuki had provided something light years more effective than a second-hand narrative. She'd shown Brianna Hill threatening and then raping the victim. She had presented proof. She expected that Giftos would tell the jurors that the video was open to interpretation. But was it? The jury had been exposed to the rape as if they had been inside Mark's actual bedroom, staring down the barrel of Brianna Hill's actual gun. The judge said,
"Mr. Christopher, you're still under oath. Understand?"
Mark nodded. The judge said,
"Court reporter has to hear you. Is that a yes?"
"Yes. I understand that I'm under oath."
Rathburn said.
Mr. Giftos, are you ready to cross-examine the witness?
Giftos stood, smoothed his tie, and said,
Sidebar, Your Honor.
Judge Rathburn couldn't keep the irritation off his face.
Approach, he said.
Yuki and Art got up from their seats and met Giftos and Benson at the bench. Judge Rathburn put his hand over the mic and said to James Giftos,
Make it good, Counselor.
We've just uncovered some new evidence.
During the recess?
We found voicemail messages from Mr. Christopher to Ms. Hill after the so-called rape.
Judge Rathburn growled,
In my chambers.
Chapter 75 The four attorneys and the judge trooped out and convened in Rathburn's office. This time the judge didn't sit. He said,
How did these messages come to light at just this moment, James? Convince me.
Can do, Your Honor. After the incident in question, Mr. Christopher started dogging my client. He wanted to go out with her. She brushed him off. Then he started calling and emailing with threats to blackmail her.
Judge Rathburn, this is the first I've heard about blackmail threats, said Yuki.
Giftos didn't look at her. He said,
Until now, they were unsubstantiated. Brianna avoided Christopher and stopped answering his calls and email. When he went to the police, management at the ad shop put Brianna on unpaid leave. She never cleared messages from her office phone.
Until now? The judge said.
We grilled her during the recess,
said Giftos, looking very much like the proverbial cat after consuming the canary.
We asked if there was anything at all we could use to refute Mr. Christopher's bullshit. Pardon me, his lies. She remembered that there were unanswered calls on her office phone. It was a Hail Mary.
Yuki's heart thudded almost audibly. The judge was listening in earnest.
Keep talking, he said.
Giftos went on.
We called her office number and accessed the voicemail system. It still retained her undeleted new messages. There were three messages from Mr. Christopher, none longer than 6 seconds. The first two messages were essentially, call me or else. The last one was another coded threat. I've transcribed these messages by hand, said James Giftos. We also recorded the time-stamped audio. Of course, we preserved the original messages on her voicemail at the agency.
Giftos handed his pen and ink transcript of the three phone messages and a pocket tape recorder to Judge Rathburn. Judge Rathburn passed the transcript to Yuki and asked Giftos to play the recorder. He did it. As Giftos had said, the calls had all been made within a week of the incident, and the technical quality was good. Yuki said,
Your Honor, these calls are vague and ambiguous.
I'm allowing them in,
said Rathburn. Yuki felt a vortex opening under her feet, but she steadied herself, dragged herself back from the terrible sinking feeling. She wouldn't go down. She couldn't go down. She followed Judge Rathburn back to the courtroom. Back at their table, Art said so quietly only she could hear him,
Don't worry. Don't worry. You've got this.
If only she could be sure. There were two opposing stories. Only one of them was true. Which one? And whom would the jury believe? Chapter 76 Mark Christopher was fidgeting in the witness box, staring out over the heads of the court officers, looking to where his parents sat in the gallery. Judge Rathburn pulled his chair up to the bench, appearing to Yuki as if he'd crossed his maximum irritation threshold. Even the jurors looked like they were ready to scream, Come on already! As for James Giftos, Yuki knew that he was on his mark, all set, and good to go. Giftos stood and, holding notes and sheets of paper in his hand, walked across the floor and addressed the witness. He said,
Mr. Christopher, I have here a transcript of your deposition with my associates and myself. Could you please read the highlighted section aloud?
Giftos handed the paper to Mark who skimmed the transcript and then began to read.
Jay Giftos, what did you and Brianna talk about in the restaurant bar before going back to your apartment? I answered, I don't really remember. I was getting pretty drunk. I just wanted to go to sleep.
Giftos thanked Mark and took back the paper.
Mr. Christopher, you just testified to something very different from what you swore to in your deposition. You told this court that you broke off your relationship with Ms. Hill during dinner, that she was clingy and hysterical, and that she insisted on spending the night so you could revisit the issue in the morning. Is that still your testimony?
That's what happened. I mean, yes.
How so, Mr. Christopher? You've made two opposing sworn statements, one in my office and one in this courtroom, isn't that right?
Mark said,
You do realize that this is a complicated issue, Mr. Giftos. I was raped by a woman I had feelings for. This is not a linear situation. I'm still trying to understand how she got over on me. I could work on this in therapy for the rest of my life.
You made two opposing sworn statements. Yes or no?
This isn't a yes or no kind of thing, I'm telling you.
Giftos said,
Your Honor, permission to treat the witness as hostile.
Go ahead, said Rathburn.
Mr. Christopher, answer the questions. Don't hypothesize. Don't rationalize. Don't make excuses. Get me?
Yes, sir, Your Honor.
The judge said to defense counsel,
Mr. Giftos, please proceed.
Chapter 77. James Giftos stuck his hands in his pockets and said,
Mr. Christopher, do you need me to repeat the question?
Mark looked more annoyed than chastened.
Yes, he said. Good idea.
Giftos said,
You've made two opposing sworn statements about what transpired between you and Ms. Hill in the restaurant. Yes or no?
Christopher said,
Both are true. We made small talk, and she got hysterical when I tried to break up with her.
Giftos said,
In fact, neither story is true, is it? While you were drinking together in that bar, you told Ms. Hill that you'd like to experiment with a sex game, didn't you?
No, said Mark. I did not.
Isn't it true that you told her that you'd like her to act out a rape scene in which she threatened you with a gun and you pretended to be the victim?
No, definitely not.
Giftos said,
Isn't it a fact, Mr. Christopher, that you suggested this sexual role-playing with a plan in mind to entrap Ms. Hill?
No. No way, I did not. That's totally crazy, said Mark.
Let me ask you this. Did you know that it is illegal to record a person in a sex act without his or her knowledge?
I thought she was going to kill me.
Really? Mr. Christopher, did you know that Ms. Hill had just come into a sizable inheritance?
I guess so. Yes.
Mr. Christopher,
Giftos said pleasantly,
we've uncovered some voicemails from you to Ms. Hill that were left on her office phone. Could you tell us if this is your voice?
You're saying I made the calls?
Yuki tried to beam a thought to Mark.
Answer the questions in as few words as possible. Do not give Giftos any shit. Do not.
I'm going to play them now,
said Giftos. He held the small recording device and pressed a button. As each message played, the mechanical voice of the phone system announced the date and time. First message.
Brianna, for the last time, call me. I'm serious.
Second message.
It's Mark. You shouldn't screw with me, Brianna. Call me.
Third message.
Brianna, I've had enough. Either you pay up, or there are going to be some traffic problems in San Francisco.
Giftos stopped the recorder and said to Mark,
Is this your voice?
Yes, sounds like me.
When you said to Ms. Hill, either you pay up or there are going to be traffic problems, what did you mean?
That was a saying, like from Fort Lee, New Jersey.
I understand the reference, but what did you mean, pay up?
I don't even know. I just said it.
I was trying to get hold of her so I could get closure on what she did to me.
Giftos said,
So once again, I ask you, when you phoned Ms. Hill in the week following your overnight date and left this message, you pay up or it's time for some traffic problems in San Francisco, you were reinforcing your blackmail attempt on Ms. Hill, weren't you? You pay up, or I'll go public with the video.
Yuki said, I object, Your Honor. There is no evidence of a blackmail threat.
Rathburn said,
Overruled. It's relevant, and I want to hear this. Mr. Giftos, ask your question again. Mr. Christopher, were you blackmailing Ms. Hill?
Not at all, Mark said. Far from it.
All I wanted was to talk to her. I needed to talk to her. She did this to me. Raped me and left me lying there like roadkill. I needed an explanation. She needed to apologize. I needed something from her, and you bastard, he said to Giftos. You should be disbarred for even suggesting this crap.
Judge Rathburn said,
Mr. Christopher, I'm warning you. Any more outbursts and I will find you in contempt. I will fine you, too. Jurors, you will disregard Mr. Christopher's personal remarks to Mr. Giftos, and the clerk will strike those remarks from the record.
Giftos said,
Thank you, Your Honor.
To the witness, he said,
I guess we'll let the jury decide what you meant when you left a message for this wealthy young woman, whom you had recorded in a compromising act that you orchestrated. Pay up or else.
Yuki was on her feet.
Argumentative, Your Honor.
Sustained.
Giftos said,
Your Honor, I have nothing more for this witness at this time, but I reserve the right to question him again.
The judge asked Yuki,
Redirect, Ms. Castellano?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yuki approached the witness and said,
Mark, please tell the jury what you have to gain by accusing the defendant of rape.
Christopher wiped his eyes with the back of his hand and said,
I don't want or need her money and never have. I'm here to get justice and peace of mind. She shouldn't get away with what she did to me.
Thanks, Mark. I have no further questions.
Rathburn told Mark Christopher that he could step down. With much bumping and limping, Yuki's star witness left the courtroom. When the doors had closed behind him, Yuki said to the court,
The people rest their case.
Judge Rathburn said,
Okay. Mr. Giftos, you're up with your opening statement.
Chapter 78 James Giftos had delayed making his opening statement until after the prosecution had concluded its case. Yuki knew that it was risky to let the jury steep in the prosecution's theory for 4 days. But James was smart, a trial-tested veteran with an impressive record of wins. He surely had a plan, and it was about to be revealed. In the next few minutes, he would begin to present his defense, in which he would do everything possible to blow up the prosecution's case and win the jury over to Brianna Hill's side. She watched Giftos walk back to his table, return the notes and transcripts to a file folder, exchange looks with his client, and respond to a note from his second chair. Yuki was glad that Art was here to witness what could well be a masterclass in how to deliver an opening statement. Giftos walked into the well, faced the jurors, and began,
Brianna Hill is the victim here. Mark Christopher is a liar, and his accusations are damned lies. Even the video the prosecution produced is a lie, and in fact was a planned setup by Mr. Christopher. He designed the scene, directed it, and edited it by turning on the recording device after the discussion of the role-playing had been agreed upon. This way, the viewer would see only a staged sex game. Without the prologue, it's understandable that this entirely orchestrated drama would seem real. As you have heard, Mark and Brianna were co-workers. They dated and had sex. And when the flames cooled for Ms. Hill and she let Mark know that she wanted to see other men, Mr. Christopher became angry.
And he came up with a scheme to hurt Ms. Hill.
Why?
Because my client had lost interest in him and he was in love with her. An attractive, wealthy, powerful young woman who was rejecting him. Mr. Christopher wasn't just angry. He was determined to hurt her financially, destroy her reputation, and even send her to jail.
Giftos paused for effect, and when he was sure that the jury was dying for him to begin again, he did.
Giftos said, "On the night in question, when they were in the restaurant bar, Mr. Christopher told Ms. Hill, and she will tell you, that he wanted to act out a rape scene with himself in the role of victim."
Giftos proceeded to summarize the defense's version of the crime for the jury.
Ms. Hill thought she knew Mr. Christopher and was intrigued by his proposition. She had never role-played before. He told her what to do, and as agreed, he would pretend to protest as she tied him up and made demands.
"The morning after this overnight date," said Giftos, "Ms. Hill went to the office, feeling that she'd betrayed herself by going along with Mr. Christopher's game. But she had no idea that she'd been played, and was about to be victimized by his extortion scheme. Mr. Christopher asked her to go out with him again several times, and when she refused, he went to her office and told her that he had recorded their sex play. He wanted a payout of $250,000, or he would post the video on the web. Ms. Hill told him to get lost, and that's when Mr. Christopher took the video recording to the police. Ms. Hill was arrested and charged with a felony that she did not commit. Mr. Christopher's premeditated extortion scheme cost my client her job and her reputation, and now she is forced to defend herself against the false testimony of this vicious and vengeful man. Please, don't let him get away with it."
Chapter 79. Brianna Hill, wearing dark gray jersey down to her boots, looked as vulnerable as a soaked kitten as she took the witness stand. Giftos took her through the events of October 11th, and she responded with her version of the conversation in the bar, in which Mark introduced the idea of the rape sex game and beyond.
"What were your thoughts the day after?" he asked.
"I felt disgusted with myself. I hadn't enjoyed the role-playing. And Mark still reported to me. We had work to do. I asked him to meet with the creative team about a Kronos commercial that had been approved. He said, 'You bet, right away.' He had worked on other Kronos commercials. It's a plum account. But this time he didn't follow up. I asked him a second time, and again he said okay and blew it off. I had to assign another producer."
"How did Mark react to your executive decision?"
"He didn't respond at all to losing the Kronos spot, but he called me on my cell 3 days after what happened in his apartment. He asked me out again. I told him no, that we were through. I told him that if he didn't snap out of it and do his job, I was going to have to report him to management."
"What did he say to that?"
"He laughed at me. He told me I didn't know what trouble was."
"Did you ask him to explain what he meant by that?"
"Yes. I remember. Mark came to my office after work. He was sitting on the couch talking to me from across the room. He said, 'You're a star, you know.' I said, 'What are you talking about, Mark?' I was waiting for a client to call. Mark said, 'I watched that video of you raping me, and wow, you are something else.' He grabbed his crotch."
Her last words came out cracked into pieces.
Giftos said,
"Do you need a moment, Brianna?"
"No."
She cleared her throat and said,
"So he told me that he had recorded our sex and that he wanted me to deposit $250,000 into his brokerage account. Otherwise, he would post the video to YouTube, Facebook, and internet porn sites."
Brianna pulled back, showing indignation, and at the same time her eyes were screwed up and her face was crumpled. She reached for a tissue from the judge's box and covered her eyes. When James Giftos spoke again, his client looked startled and dazed.
"And how did you respond, Brianna, to this extortion attempt?"
"I dismissed the demand for money at first. How could he be serious about that? But it was easy for Mark to set up a hidden camera. He's a professional film producer. I was scared to death.
I told him that he was crazy. And I mean, I saw for the first time that he was actually crazy for real.
Did you call the police?
No. I still hadn't wrapped my mind around the extortion. I was furious about the video. I didn't know if he was even telling the truth. Then the call from my client came in. I asked him to hold on. I put my hand over the receiver and said something like, "No more threats, Mark. Let me know if you still want to work in production." Mark left, and I thought of how much crap would rain down on me if I fired him for insubordination. I mean, that was true. He just stopped doing his job, but he could call it sexual harassment. How could I prove otherwise?
Did you tell anyone about Mark's extortion threat?
Finally, I told my sister Angela. She's a lawyer. Estates and trusts. She said, "He'll never do it. Extortion is a felony."
Giftos said, "What happened after that?"
Stories started circulating around the agency that I had threatened Mark with a loaded gun, that I had raped him, and that he could prove it. I denied it, of course, and set up a meeting with our CEO, Mr. Keeley, to report Mark. But before I saw Mr. Keeley, Mark took the video to the police, and they arrested me for something he dreamed up in the depths of his very sick mind.
Chapter 80. Yuki found Brianna's testimony credible and very compelling. She tried to shut down her sympathy for the young woman and thought about how to get the jury to do the same. She approached the witness.
"Ms. Hill, have you ever heard the expression buyer's remorse?"
"Yes."
"It means after a purchase, the buyer has regrets. Would you go along with me on that definition?"
"Okay."
"Is that what happened to you? You decided to rape Mark and afterward realized you'd made a bad mistake?"
"I regretted going along with him. That's all."
Yuki had an idea for a line of questioning that she might get away with up to a point. It was worth a try, even if Judge Rathburn smacked her down. She said,
"Ms. Hill, after the police arrested you for raping Mr. Christopher, you were released on bond, weren't you?"
"Yes."
"But you were arrested again, weren't you? Why?"
Giftos was on his feet yelling, "Objection! Relevance!"
Yuki knew that Brianna's return to jail had nothing to do with the rape, but it would raise questions in the jurors' minds. Why was she back in jail? Did she shoot Mark Christopher?
Yuki said, "Withdrawn, Your Honor."
Rathburn said,
"You know, you're walking a fine line, Ms. Castellano."
She said, "Sorry, Your Honor,"
thinking she'd made a good decision. Desperate times called for desperate measures. She turned back to the witness.
"Ms. Hill, would you say that it's risky to date someone who reports to you?"
"I do now."
Yuki asked,
"Are you telling us that you've had other interoffice relationships?"
"Objection!" Giftos shouted. "Sustained."
"I want to answer," said the witness.
The judge said to her,
"You understand that the question does not apply to the action against you. As your attorney was about to say at the top of his lungs, anything that does not pertain to this case is irrelevant."
"I understand. I want to set the record straight."
"Then go ahead."
Brianna said,
"Interoffice dating is no big deal in advertising. I have dated people I've worked with, but I've never done anything like what I did with Mark that night. I should never have done it. He sold me on it, saying it would be fun. It wasn't fun. And it wasn't a crime. It was regrettable."
And with that, Brianna started to cry and couldn't seem to stop. The judge spoke her name.
Her lawyer stood up and said, "Your Honor, can you give the witness a few moments?"
Yuki found Hill's sobs heartrending. But would the jury find her convincing? If Yuki pushed her any further, she risked coming off as a bully.
"Thank you, Ms. Hill. I have no further questions," she said.
Rathburn told the defendant that she could step down and called the court into recess. Out in the hallway, Yuki told Arthur,
"I didn't have a hook to hang my hat on."
He said,
"Didn't hurt. Could have helped. She doesn't seem stable."
Yuki checked her phone and saw that she had a dozen missed calls. One of them was from Red Dog. She called him back.
Talk to me,
he said.
Giftos has got 3 character witnesses on deck, she said. Brianna's sister, her boss at the agency, and her ex-boyfriend of about a year prior to her relationship with Mark. They're all going to say she's a fantastic person.
You still like our chances?
What I think is that she's naive. He's calculating. Whether this rape was her idea or his, she was never an even match for him. As things stand right now, there's enough reasonable doubt to fill a freight train. My gut, Yuki said, tells me that this jury is going to hang.
Harisi said,
My gut says make time to go over your closing argument with me.
Will do, said Yuki.
She welcomed input from Harisi, because she believed Brianna's story, and that worried her. Chapter 81 Conklin and I were at our desks Monday morning when he said to me,
Want to go for a ride?
I said, When I say that to Martha, she goes nuts. Conklin cracked up, then held up some keys.
Get your leash. We're going on a mystery road trip. I've checked out a squad car.
I'd just returned after a weekend of bed rest that I had truly needed. 100 emails were waiting in my inbox, and I had 1,000,000 questions for Conklin about our ongoing homicide case. My first cup of Java sat untouched and chilling on my desk. I really needed to work. I tried to get my partner to tell me what he wanted me to see, but I couldn't budge him. He wouldn't even give me a hint. I finally gave up. How long is this going to take? I asked.
Trust me. You'll like this. Get up, Boxer.
I threw a big sigh, gulped down half my coffee, pulled on my jacket, and said, What are we waiting for? We took the stairs down to the lobby, left by the rear door, and speedwalked along the breezeway to Harriet Street, where a standard gray Chevy squad car was parked under the overpass. Conklin took the wheel, and we headed out toward the Mission District. Over the crackle of the police radio, my partner started to fill me in.
I spent Friday afternoon at Millie's favorite homeless shelter.
I take it you learned something useful? I turned up the heat, turned down the radio.
I did,
Conklin said.
Millie's maiden name was Renee Millicent Cushing. 30 years ago, she married an accountant by the name of Ronald Dunn.
She's married? I said. Jeez. Did anyone notify her husband?
He died 15 years ago of a heart attack. She told us that she has 2 adult kids. We didn't ask their names. But I have an address.
4?
You shall see, he told me.
We cruised through the gritty commercial section of the Mission, which broke out into the residential community of Eureka Valley. This is an upscale area, lined with the lovely Victorian homes our town is known for. I was sightseeing as we drove up hilly Collingwood Street when Conklin pulled the car up to a gray wood frame house. It was nice, plain, well kept, and it looked like it had been built in the mid-60s. There was a green Kia in the driveway with a Berkeley sticker in the rear window. I said, Who lives here?
Used to be Millie Cushing Dunn's house. Yeah, I know what you're going to say. She owned a house?
And it's a nice house, too.
Her husband left it to her with a bunch of money, amount unspecified, but enough that she had plenty to spare, said Conklin.
I was impressed. Nice work, partner.
Here's the rest of it. According to the administrator at the shelter, Millie was a social worker. She often posed as a homeless person to gain trust, lived on the street 3 or 4 days a week, then stepped it up to 24/7.
Odd way to go about gaining trust, huh?
I'd say. Ready, Boxer?
We got out of the car and walked up to the front door. Conklin rang the bell. Chapter 82 A woman in her mid-20s opened the door about a foot, enough for us to see that she was barefoot, wearing yoga pants and a loose top. I thought that she looked a little like Millie.
May I help you?
She asked. Conklin badged her, introduced us, and asked,
"Do you know Millie Cushing?"
The woman said, "I'm her daughter, Sophie Dunn. What's wrong? What happened to my mother?"
Conklin said,
"I'm sorry to tell you, but she was shot last week on Mission Street, and unfortunately, she died. It took us this long to find her address. We're very sorry."
"She's dead?"
Sophie Dunn spun away from the doorway and cried out,
"No, no, no, that can't be right. She can't be dead. She can't be."
The door swung open, and we walked Millie's distraught daughter through the entranceway to a sitting room with a brick fireplace, wall-to-wall bookshelves, and a large window onto a high city view. She circled the room, still crying out denials.
"This isn't right. I don't believe this. How did this happen?"
Then she stopped circling and, with tears streaming down her cheeks, said directly to me,
"I always hoped that one day I would have my mother back. Do you understand?"
And then, wiping her face with her sleeve, Sophie Dunn collapsed into a chair. When we were seated across from her, I told her again how sorry we were, that we had known Millie and why. I said, "Ms. Dunn, I'm confused as to why your mother was living as though she was homeless." Sophie got up, paced some more, and eventually got her thoughts and words together enough to confirm what Conklin had learned at the shelter. Millie's street life had begun after her husband's death. By the time Sophie was in her teens, Millie was on the street more than she was home.
"I haven't seen her in over a year," Millie's daughter told us. "But when we last spoke, she seemed happy. She liked the people. She would give anyone her last nickel. I can't even imagine who could have anything against her. But as I'm sure you know, a lot of street people have mental illnesses. My mother included."
She went over to the bookshelf and came back to her chair with a framed photo taken in front of this fireplace. I got a glimpse of a family of four. Mom, Dad, two kids. Normal as could be. Conklin asked,
"Sophie, did your brother stay in touch with your mom?"
"Michael? He hardly stays in touch with me. After he moved out, he got married, got divorced, and kind of lives a small, quiet life. Mom wasn't at the wedding. He never mentions her."
"We'll need to speak to him," Rich said.
Sophie began crying again. She apologized, left the room, and returned a minute later with tissues and a post-it note. She said,
"Here's his number. Good luck getting anywhere with him, though. Michael is a professional introvert."
Sophie asked when she could see her mother. I gave her the information as well as my card, and we said our goodbyes. Conklin called Michael Dunn from the car and got him on the first try. He agreed to meet us at the hall. Chapter 83. 3 hours after leaving Sophie Dunn, Conklin and I were sitting at a small table in Interview One with her older brother, Michael. Conklin took the lead, and I used the opportunity to look Michael over. Dunn was about 30, of medium height and build, with dark hair, a 5 o'clock shadow, and his mother's kind hazel eyes. He was wearing office job attire, a dark gray sports coat, blue button-down shirt, standard striped tie, gray slacks, and notably, a wedding band. I wondered about that. Sophie Dunn had said her brother was divorced. Conklin was telling Dunn where the shooting had taken place and the results of the autopsy. I looked at Millie's son for signs of grief or shock, but Michael was showing very little emotion.
"She put herself in danger," he said. "But why would someone kill her? She was harmless and not confrontational."
"When was the last time you spoke with your mother?" I asked.
3 years ago, maybe? I don't exactly remember. She doesn't carry a phone, or maybe she didn't give me the number. I stopped by the house a few times, but I never caught her at home."
He shook his head.
"She wasn't right in the head after my dad died. She left school, moved back home, but she detached from me, Sophie, the house. For her, it was all about being with the homeless."
I said, That must have felt pretty bad.
He shrugged and then said,
I don't see how I can help you.
I changed my tack. I said, your wedding band. Sophie said you were divorced?
There it was at last, a flickering, barely there hint of sadness on his face.
He said,
my ex called her thoroughly nutty Millie.
Anyway, there's no reason to take the ring off. I like it. I don't like change.
And yet his life had been disrupted by his father's death, his mother's absence, and then a divorce that Michael apparently hadn't accepted as final. I felt a flash of pity for Michael, and I bought Sophie's view that he was an introvert. But it was odd that he had no curiosity about his mother's death. And the few times he made eye contact, I thought he was trying to get a fix on me. I said, Mr. Dunn, we're totally in the dark here. Anything you can add, even a guess, would be appreciated. I liked your mother, and I really want to catch her killer.
Dunn twisted the band on his ring finger, calling my attention to it again. It was pretty nice. White gold with rims of yellow gold. He said to me,
as I've told you, I don't know her friends, her habits, or anything about what happened to her. I can't even guess.
Then he looked away.
I said, I have to ask, Mr. Dunn. Where were you the night your mother was shot?
Me? What night was that again? No, it doesn't matter, said Michael Dunn wearily. I have the same routine every day and every night. I get to work at 9. I do research for the 3 lawyers at Peavey and Smith Financial Management. I eat lunch at my desk. I leave work at 6, come home, nuke dinner, watch TV for a few hours, and then I go to bed after the news. That's my Groundhog Day life. It's what I want. No stress, quiet, predictable.
And he had a predictable alibi, too. I didn't like that. Something was going on with Michael Dunn that he hadn't told us. Never mind what he said. What did he know? He looked at his watch and said,
look, I've got a stack of documents and a needy boss waiting for them. I hope you catch Mom's killer. She was batty, but she didn't deserve to be shot.
He got up from his chair and put on his windbreaker jacket.
If you catch the guy, let me know, okay?
Conklin said,
of course,
and walked Michael Dunn out to the elevator. I sat for a moment and stared at the wall. I thought about Michael Dunn's glancing looks, like he wanted to study me yet avoid my eyes. But I had looked at him, and now I was thinking that I'd seen him before. It would drive me crazy until I figured out when and where. Chapter 84. Back at our desks, I said to Conklin, does Michael Dunn look familiar to you?
Reminds me a little of Jimmy Fallon, maybe.
You think? The feeling I was having that I'd seen Dunn before intensified. I kept comparing him in my mind with his sister and mother, but even though they all had hazel eyes, I just didn't feel that was it. And then, something clicked. I opened the folder on my computer where I'd filed the shots I'd snapped of the crowd behind the tape on that rainy night on Geary Street. I scrutinized all of them before I stabbed my finger at the face of a man who strongly resembled Michael Dunn. Millie had looked startled when I showed these same photos to her. Had she seen her son in that crowd? Come over here, Richie.
Yes, boss.
He came around, looked at where I was pointing. Is this Michael? The man at the end of a row of bystanders wore a knit cap and a charcoal gray ski jacket. His right hand was in his pocket, and he was holding an umbrella handle with his gloveless left hand. Water dripped from the umbrella spokes.
Could be him, Boxer. The picture is awful grainy, and it's hard to really see his face with that hat pulled down over his eyebrows. But I see what you mean.
I zoomed in on the hand gripping the handle and focused in on the man's wedding ring. I said to Richie, you noticed his ring, right?
Silver with gold on the edges.
Correct, I said. Is this the same ring?
It's possible,
my partner said.
But with this lighting? The shadows, the headlights, a lot of contrast for a phone shot. I want to look at his face again.
I adjusted the picture on the screen and said, well?
Let's go to the videotape, Rich said.
He went to his desk, picked up the phone, and tapped in a couple of numbers, saying,
Maybe we'll catch Benny.
Benny is our interview room AV tech, among other roles.
Benny,
Conklin said into the mouthpiece,
this is urgent. I need a still shot of the dude Boxer and I just talked to in interview one. Find me the best frontal face shot and a profile if you've got one. You mind? I'll wait.
He hung up and drummed his fingers on the desk. I knew he and I were both having the same thought. The lab could do a little facial recognition magic on the two images. Compare the Michael Dunn we'd just interviewed with the unknown man under the umbrella on Geary. While we waited for Benny, I did a database search for everything related to Michael Dunn. I didn't find much. He had no arrest sheet, no prints on file, not even a traffic violation. And then I got a hit. I said, holy moly, and rotated my monitor so Rich could read a line of type in the database. Michael Dunn of Union Street, San Francisco, had a registered 9mm Kimber handgun.
Good catch, said Rich.
Thanks, bud. It was a good catch. Michael Dunn had purchased a gun of the same caliber as the one that had killed several homeless people, including Dunn's mother, Millie Cushing. The lab had kept the bullets taken from the bodies of Jimmy Dolan, Laura Russell, Lou Doe, and Millie Cushing. Ballistics had logged them all as cold hits. All had been fired from the same gun, a gun that had not been used in a crime or otherwise entered into our system. It wasn't a gotcha. Yet. But if the mystery man on Geary Street was our Michael Dunn, and he had a weapon that matched the type that had fired bullets into his mother's body, that would be enough probable cause to arrest him on suspicion of murder. Had those bullets come from Michael Dunn's Kimber? We really needed to get his gun. Chapter 85. It was 8:30 a.m. the morning after our interview with Michael Dunn. Conklin and I sat together in a parked squad car near the intersection of Leedsdorf and Commercial Streets in the Financial District. The Transamerica building was directly behind us, and we were within shouting distance of the red and white brick three-story office building where Dunn worked as a paralegal. We had confirmation from the lab that the man in our interview room was the same as the one I'd snapped standing across the street from the body of that poor dead woman on Geary. Michael Dunn hadn't said a word to us about the scene on Geary. Why wouldn't he mention that he'd seen the body, as similar as it was to what he now knew about his mother's death? We could ask him and hold him as a material witness for 48 hours while we got an ADA to get us a search warrant for his apartment. But neither Rich nor I could bear to sit at our desks while waiting for an ADA to find a judge to sign a warrant. Not while our one suspect, Michael Dunn, was walking around with a gun. Our plan was simple and entirely legal. We would pick Dunn up and bring him back to the hall for questioning about the shooting of Lou Doe at 77 Geary. That would buy a little time, and maybe Dunn would give up information we could use to arrest him for murder. Dunn had told us that he was a creature of habit. Every morning he got to his office by 9, he spent his day doing legal research, and at the close of business he went home. What he'd called his Groundhog Day life. I hoped today would be just another Groundhog Day for Michael Dunn. I turned the police radio down to a hiss and watched the early morning traffic on Leedsdorf, a charming street a few blocks from Sidney G. Walton Square, 8 or 9 blocks from both 77 Geary and the spot on Mission Street where Millie Cushing had been gunned down a week ago. It had been very loud on Mission after Millie died. I remembered every minute of that night with high-definition clarity. I had stood there in the fog, surrounded by flashing red and blue lights, with the shrieks of law enforcement vehicle sirens speeding toward the murder scene from all points. If he was strolling around the area at that time, Michael could have seen the light show. Hell, he could have called dispatch himself. Chapter 86. I felt the adrenaline rush before my brain made the connection. Michael Dunn was walking toward his office building right on time. I said to Richie, There. See him? The man who more or less resembled Jimmy Fallon was passing the intersection at Commercial Street, heading toward us on Leedsdorf, in the direction of the three-story building where he worked 9 to 6, 5 days a week. He wore a knit cap over his brow, and both hands were shoved into the pockets of his windbreaker. He looked straight ahead and passed our backup team without noticing them. I grabbed the radio mic and said to Nardoni, "Bob, suspect is on foot walking north on Leedsdorf, just past you, wearing a black jacket, black knit hat."
"Copy that,"
Nardoni said. "Stay in your car until I need you." Conklin and I got out of the squad car and walked toward Dunn, stopping him on the sidewalk. I said, "Mr. Dunn, glad we found you. We need to ask you some more questions."
"I have a meeting at 9:15,
he said.
"Why don't I get back to you?"
He started to walk past us, but Conklin put out a hand to block his passage.
"I'm sorry, Mr. Dunn,"
Conklin said.
"This is very important. We have some photos to show you, and we need you to help us clear up a few questions. Has to be right now. This just can't wait." "Am I under arrest?"
"Why would you ask that?" I asked.
"Because you're coming at me like I'm a suspect."
"Mr. Dunn, Michael," I said, "we need your help. The longer it takes to find whoever shot your mother, the greater the likelihood that the case will go cold or that the shooter will kill someone else." Dunn planted his feet, and from the rage on his face, I thought he was going to punch me or run.
"Get away from me,"
he said.
"Get the hell away from me."
There was a blur as his arm shot out and connected with my shoulder. The shock of the blow knocked me off balance. I staggered back but managed to keep my footing. I unclipped my cuffs from my belt and shouted, "Put your hands behind your back! Michael Dunn, you're under arrest for assaulting a police officer!" Dunn switched his eyes to the cuffs and started babbling at me. He made no sense. I didn't know what he was thinking or saying, but one thing I did know. The gun that I wanted so badly? It was in his hand, and it was pointed at me. I rushed him and yelled, "Gun!" Chapter 87. Cars were speeding past him. Michael heard them, but his vision was breaking into choppy split seconds, like old-fashioned film caught in the cogs of a projector. One moment the cop called Boxer was coming at him. He hated her. She was just like his mother. She should be punished so no one would have to suffer like he had. But the other cop was blocking his way. "Get away from me. Get away." He gave her a shove as he clasped the butt of his beloved gun. Everything became blurred in his mind. "Mother, why? Why don't you love me?" She was coming back at him, so he aimed at her. She shouted, "Gun!" and he squeezed the trigger. He felt the shock in his hand travel up to his shoulder and ring the bell of his heart. Her partner came toward him with his gun out, shouting, "Drop the gun!" Michael laughed and fired again. Brakes squealed. The shot rang out, metal against metal. His thoughts were fleeting images. His mother.
"Why don't you love me? Why didn't you love me?"
He was down on his back. Someone stepped on his hand. His gun spun away. He rolled and reached for it. He couldn't quite get it.
"Mom, where are you now?"
Loud words came at him. He didn't understand. Faces were huge in front of his eyes. His cheek was against the pavement. Someone shouted his name. A kick landed on the side of his head, another in his gut. His wrists were clamped and pinched behind him. He was dragged up to his feet. He saw someone he knew. Roger Duncan, the boss. He heard Duncan say,
"Hey, what's going on here?"
Michael called out,
"I did it, Roger. I killed my mother. I don't need a lawyer."
His true self was coming out. He had never felt so free, so alive. There was a hand on his head, pushing him down.
"You bitch. You've always been a bitch,"
He said it to her.
Mother!
A car door slammed. Duncan knocked on the window, his face as big as the moon, saying in a muffled voice,
Michael, I'll meet you at booking. Don't say anything to anyone.
He was living in real time, with real sound and images. Michael saw it all clearly now. He said,
It's okay, Duncan. I killed my mother. I shot them all.
Michael was thrown back against the seat. He welcomed it. He started to hum a song about a puppy with a waggly tail. He was free at last. Life was good. Part 3. Chapter 88. I was at my desk in the squad room when I opened the little shopping bag and took out the note and the foil-wrapped packet. Conklin was putting on his windbreaker. He said,
Cappy and I are running across the street for lunch. Come with us.
Rain check, I said.
Prime rib special. All you can eat, $7.
I peeled back the aluminum foil and peeked between the slices of bread. Meatloaf. The note read, Eat. Love. Joe. That was priceless. When I had come home last night, Joe had taken one look at me, hugged me, pulled off my outerwear and gun and sat me down. Then he pulled off my shoes and poured me a drink.
Talk to me, he said.
Once I started talking, I couldn't stop. Joe listened to every word about the Michael Dunn takedown that morning. His discombobulated name-calling as I confronted him. The wild shots he'd fired, one of which put a new part in Sergeant Nardoni's scalp. And his confession to everything but the Kennedy assassination as we locked him in the squad car. Dunn is in a cell by himself under close guard pending his arraignment, I concluded. People on the street can breathe a little more easily tonight. Me too. Joe dished up the meatloaf and fixings, and as I ate, he told me about his Mr. Mom Day. Ducks in the park. Julie's new word, panda. A playdate for Martha. And a haircut for him that I admired. I got up from the table to run my fingers through the thick new growth of hair that hid the long, bumpy scar at the back of his head. Good haircut, I said.
It's for my interview, he said.
Even as Joe was excited at the prospect of getting back to work himself, I knew some part of him wanted me to take a desk job, have another baby, stop mixing it up with crazy people with guns. I'd tried to imagine it, but the picture just wouldn't gel. That night I ate dinner with two glasses of a nice Chianti. I slept without moving all night, like a rock or a log or a candle that had been burned at both ends. Now at my desk, I saw that the meatloaf Joe had made with loving hands was making an encore. I'm in brown bag mode, I said to my partner. Thanks anyway. As Conklin made his exit, he passed Yuki coming through the gate. Normally tightly wrapped and focused, she looked frazzled. She pulled out Conklin's now empty desk chair and dropped into the seat. Brady's in a meeting upstairs, I told her.
I know, Yuki said. I came to see you.
Chapter 89. Excellent timing, I said to Yuki. I'm lunching at my desk. What's going on? Yuki ran her hands through her hair and gladly accepted half of my sandwich. Then she said,
My case is going sideways, Linz. I'm starting to think that my star witness is a big fat liar. If that's true, the whole case against Brianna Hill might be a lie, and if so, I have to jam on the brakes, and I mean right now.
Back up a little, I said. What lies are you talking about? Yuki leaned across Conklin's desk and spilled her fears. That Mark had added fabricated details to his original story of the assault while he was under oath.
But then it got worse, Yuki said. James Giftos turned up some old phone messages from Mark to Brianna that sounded like he could have been blackmailing her.
Really? You're serious? Yuki went on, saying,
Lindsay, do you remember what I told you about Paul Yates?
I said, He's the one that had a bedroom encounter with Brianna Hill and claimed that she threatened him with a gun.
Right. Not quite a corroboration, but Yates's testimony of attempted rape with a gun validated Mark's story.